A Katra Podcast Conversations for the Curious Essential Knowledge, Simplified, your gateway to essential ideas that matter most. This audio summary has been prepared with the help of a Katra AI. Welcome back to the Deep Dive. Today, we are really getting into a complex and often painful topic, Northern Ireland. For so long, it's been the symbol of deep political conflict.
It has. And you often hear it boiled down to that very simple phrase, Catholics versus Protestants.
Exactly. Which, as we'll explore, is just, well, it misses so much of the picture.
It really does. So our aim today is to go much deeper than that simple binary. We're looking at Mark Mulholland's history of the conflict, and it forces us to see this as, you know, a political, constitutional, and identity clash. Religion was more like the uniform, the badge of belonging, rather than the root cause itself.
We want to understand how this relatively small area became the site of one of modern Europe's longest conflicts, the Troubles, as it's known. And, maybe even more crucial, what does the peace process, difficult as it's been, tell us about how deeply divided places can maybe learn to manage their disagreements without constant violence? Mulholland's work gives us that essential historical grounding.
Yeah, and he's a fantastic guide for this. Mark Mulholland, he's a respected historian, a fellow at St. Catherine's College, Oxford. His specialty is right in this area, Irish and British political history, political violence.
He seems perfectly placed.
Yeah.
Right? And what I find really valuable about his approach, especially for this kind of topic, is his balance. It's so hard to find analysis on Northern Ireland that isn't leaning heavily towards a unionist or a nationalist perspective.
Absolutely. Mulholland manages to look at the grievances and anxieties of all sides without sort of taking sides himself. He synthesizes these clashing stories.
So his authority comes less from saying this side was right, this side was wrong,
and more from explaining the underlying logic, the structure of the situation. He shows how political actors, who were actually acting quite rationally within their own worldviews and histories, ended up in this conflict that looked completely irrational from the outside. It's less about pure emotion, more about political structures clashing.
Okay, so let's unpack that central argument. Mulholland says the conflict isn't just ancient hatreds flaring up. It's about two fundamentally incompatible national identities, British unionism and Irish nationalism, claiming the same piece of land.
Right. And that clash was, you could say, built into the foundations of the state itself. Partition in 1921, when Ireland was divided, created this six-county Northern Ireland designed to have a permanent Protestant unionist majority, about two-thirds.
So it didn't solve the so-called Irish question?
Not at all. It basically just crammed the problem into a smaller box. It secured the identity and political power of one community, the Unionists, but really at the direct expense of the other, the Nationalists.
Which means the state was inherently unstable right from the get-go, because it was designed to marginalize, what, a third of its own population?
Precisely. And Mulholland traces this whole arc starting way back with the plantation of Ulster in the 1600s, moving through decades of systematic discrimination against Catholics, then the explosion of violence in the Troubles, and finally, the really intricate political solution of the 1998 Good Friday Agreement.
Okay, let's start where he does with that historical bedrock, the plantation of Ulster. Early 17th century. What was that?
Well, it was a massive demographic shift. The British Crown encouraged Protestant settlers, mainly from Scotland and England, to move onto land confiscated from native Irish Catholics. This physically created the two distinct communities living side by side, often in tension. It laid down the fault lines, you could say.
And these weren't just historical events that happened and were forgotten. Mulholland argues they became political ammunition.
Absolutely. Key moments like the Siege of Derry in 1689 or the Battle of the Boyne in 1690, these became powerful opposing myths. For Unionists, they're symbols of survival, loyalty to Britain, Protestant liberty.
Right, deliverance.
Yeah, but for Nationalists, they represent conquest, losing their land, foreign rule, and these memories weren't just passive recollections, they were actively used, weaponized, really, in political arguments centuries later to justify current positions.
Okay, so fast forward to 1921. Northern Ireland is created. The first Prime Minister, James Craig, famously said it was a Protestant state for a Protestant people. How did the system actually make that happen on the ground?
Through deliberate systemic inequality. Mulholland describes the period from 1921 up to the 1960s as a cold house for Catholics. It was about keeping the minority politically weak.
How specifically?
Well, first, gerrymandering. Electoral boundaries were drawn, often quite blatantly, to make sure Unionist candidates won, even in places where Nationalists were the local majority.
Wow. So even if demographics shifted, the political outcome was sort of baked in.
To a large extent, yes. Plus, they kept property qualifications for voting in local elections much longer than elsewhere in the UK. This disenfranchised poorer people who were disproportionately Catholic.
And practical things, like jobs and housing.
Big time.
Yeah.
There was widespread discrimination in getting public sector jobs and, crucially, in allocating council housing. If you were Catholic, you often found yourself at the very back of the queue. This went on for decades, building up huge resentment. It was like dry tinder just waiting for a spark.
Which leads us to the 1960s civil rights movement. Groups like NIAR, the Northern Ireland Civil Rights Association, they were inspired by the U.S. movement, right?
They were. And initially, their demands weren't about ending partition or Irish unity. They were asking for basic democratic rights within Northern Ireland. One man, one vote. In local elections, fair allocation of housing, ending discrimination, British rights for British citizens, essentially.
But the state didn't respond with reform.
No. And this is where Mulholland points to a catastrophic failure. The unionist government, and particularly the police force, often responded to peaceful marches with violence. Think of the images from Duke Street in Derry in 68.
Yeah.
That violent response shattered the hope among many nationalists that the system could be reformed peacefully. It pushed people towards more radical alternatives.
That failure paved the way for the IRA's resurgence.
It absolutely did. The state's actions and then the deployment of the British Army, initially welcomed by some Catholics for protection, but quickly seen as an occupying force, and especially events like Bloody Sunday in 1972.
Terrible. 13 unarmed civilians shot dead by paratroopers.
That single event was probably the Provisional IRA's biggest recruitment sergeant. It seemed to prove the argument that violence was the only language the state understood. And that plunged the region into the darkest years of the Troubles and led London to suspend the Northern Ireland government and impose direct rule.
You also mentioned the hunger strikes in 1981. How did they fit into this shift?
That was another profound moment, Republican prisoners starving themselves for political status. While it was a grim demonstration of commitment, it also had a strategic outcome. It helped convince leaders like Gerry Adams that they needed politics alongside violence, the famous Armalite and ballot box strategy. They needed a political path, too.
So violence got attention, but it wasn't winning outright for anyone.
Exactly. And that leads to what Mulholland calls the vital precondition for peace, the mutually hurting stalemate. By the late 80s, early 90s, it was becoming clear that no side could fully win. The IRA couldn't force the British out. The British military couldn't eliminate the IRA. Loyalist paramilitaries couldn't restore the old system.
Everyone was stuck.
And exhausted.
And bleeding. The human cost, the economic drain, the political impasse that created a situation where compromise, which had seemed impossible, started to look like the only rational way forward.
And out of that stalemate came the Good Friday Agreement in 1998. It's hailed as a major achievement, but what's the actual machinery inside it? It's a really sophisticated piece of political engineering. Political scientists call it consociationalism, basically. Power sharing designed for deeply divided societies.
Consociationalism.
Yeah.
Okay, break that down a bit. Does it just mean everyone gets included?
It's more structured than just inclusion. It guarantees power and representation for both main communities and puts checks on simple majority rule. The GFA rests on the principle of consent. Northern Ireland stays in the UK only as long as a majority there wants it to.
Okay.
Then you have the three strands. Strand one is internal, a devolved assembly and executive where power must be shared between unionists and nationalists. They have to govern together. No majority rule.
Mandatory coalition, basically.
You're right. Strand two creates north-south bodies linking Northern Ireland and the Republic of Ireland for cooperation on practical things like tourism or agriculture, acknowledging the Irish dimension. Strand three deals with east-west relations between Dublin and London. It locks everyone into mutual dependency.
This whole analysis feels like it offers lessons way beyond just Northern Ireland. If the structure was the problem and a new structure is the solution, what are the big themes Mulholland pulls out?
I think the first is just how complex identity really is. We said it wasn't simply about religious belief. Religion was the label, the marker it defined, your community, your school, sometimes your street, your political allegiance. But identities are messy, layered, sometimes contradictory. You can't just legislate them away.
Right. And that connects to the second theme you mentioned earlier, historical memory. It's not just remembering the past neutrally.
Definitely not. Events like the Boyne or the plantation become these active narratives. Mm. They're constantly reinterpreted and used in the present to justify grievances, to rally support, to explain why the other side can't be trusted. History is alive and kicking in everyday politics there.
And the third big theme seems pretty sobering.
Mm.
Violence ultimately didn't work for anyone's main goals.
Yeah, I mean, violence forced change. It got issues onto the table that were ignored before. But Mulholland is very clear. It failed to achieve the big objectives. The IRA didn't get a united Ireland. Loyalists didn't secure the old-style unionist dominance. Real, lasting solutions had to come through political compromise, not through the gun.
Mulholland really does have a knack for boiling down these huge ideas into sharp phrases. Let's share a few of those key quotes or concepts.
Okay. The first one really nails the problem with the original state. Northern Ireland was created not as a solution to the Irish problem, but as the institutionalization of that problem within a smaller area.
Wow. So instability wasn't a bug, it was a feature from day one.
Exactly. It was baked in.
Mm-hmm.
And the second quote gives us a realistic take on the peace deal. The Good Friday Agreement did not resolve the Northern Ireland conflict. It transformed it from a violent conflict into a peaceful one.
Meaning the disagreements are still there.
But hopefully the way of dealing with them has changed. Peace is about managing conflict, not necessarily eliminating it entirely. It's an ongoing process.
And the third one feels like the core lesson, maybe for conflicts everywhere. Peace in Northern Ireland required not the victory of one side over the other, but the recognition that both sides had legitimate interests that needed to be accommodated.
That shift from zero sum, I win, you lose, to positive sum, we both need to get something, is crucial. And that's probably the biggest takeaway for real life applications, especially in conflict resolution.
Yeah, the idea of inclusive negotiations, how do they manage that? Bringing people like, you know, former paramilitary leaders like Gary Adams or hardline unionists like Ian Paisley into the actual talks, that seems incredibly risky.
It is risky, but the thinking was if you leave the spoilers, the people capable of wrecking the peace outside the process, they'll have every incentive to wreck it. Bringing them inside, making them sign on, gives them a stake in making it work. It binds them to the outcome. It required huge political will from all sides and international support, too.
And for other divided societies, those consociational tools you mentioned, power sharing, proportional representation.
And those mutual vetoes, like the petition of concern in the assembly, these are mechanisms designed specifically to prevent a majority trampling on a minority's vital interests. It forces cooperation, even if grudgingly. It's political engineering for stability in fractured places.
But it's not a magic wand, is it? You mentioned peace as a process.
Absolutely. And it requires constant work. Things like segregated housing and, crucially, segregated education are still huge issues in Northern Ireland, dealing with the legacy of the past, the victims, the trauma that's ongoing and very difficult. Peace isn't just signing a document. It's changing society day by day.
And we have to mention the huge spanner Brexit threw into the works.
We do. Mulholland touches on this. The UK leaving the EU, and especially the Northern Ireland Protocol that effectively put a customs border in the Irish Sea between Great Britain and Northern Ireland, well, that fundamentally upset the delicate balance of the Good Friday Agreement for many unionists. It's reignited constitutional anxieties and has repeatedly destabilized the power-sharing institutions. It shows just how fragile that peace still is.
So wrapping up, what's the most profound insight you take from Mulholland's analysis?
For me, it's the lesson that even conflicts that seem absolutely intractable, rooted in centuries of history and deep identity divides, can actually be transformed. It takes incredible patience, skilled negotiation, and real innovation in designing political structures. It kind of challenges simpler ideas about how democracy has to work.
Yeah, what really strikes me is the human element of that transformation. You mentioned Paisley and Adams. The thought of Ian Paisley, the ultimate Dr. No, eventually sharing power, even chuckling in press conferences with Martin McGuinness, a former IRA chief. I mean, that's astounding. It shows leaders can take massive risks and find totally new ways to define what winning looks like. Maybe winning becomes finding a way to live together. That political courage is quite something.
It really is. A flawed peace, maybe, but a peace nonetheless, with powerful lessons for us all.
See you next time with another remarkable thinker, another powerful book, and another idea that has shaped our world. This audio summary is brought to you by Ekutra Foundation.